Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the role of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. My name is Ethan Clow, your host, and as always, we are broadcasting here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on your radio dial, as well as streaming online at citr.ca, and of course, via podcast whenever, wherever, as technology permits. And of course, that was a bit of a different musical opening for this sector. Hope you liked it. Maybe we'll keep it. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, we have a fantastic show today. I'm glad you're all here to join us. This past week has been CITR's annual fund drive. So for those of you who don't know, or maybe just tuned in recently, every year CITR asks our listeners to donate to help support the station, help support programming on the station, and help us out with our operating costs. Basically, help keep CITR going for another year, producing great content and great material. Well, it's been a great success. The fund drive is officially over as of right now. However, you still can donate if you haven't already. So maybe if you just tuned in right now, or if you're listening a few weeks after the fact, still feel free to throw a few dollars CITR's way. CITR's goal is to raise $40,000, which will cover its operating budget, as well as expanding CITR's operations, including creating a new website, digitizing our old archives of the Discorder magazine, as well as the decades of CITR content that was produced. Well, I mean, this station has been around for nearly 70 years, so there's a lot of extra content out there that very fragile and holds a lot of historic value in terms of interviews and culture and news and music. We want to preserve that, so donating helps us do that. So if you haven't donated already and you want to give it some thought, that's great. You can donate online at citr.ca, as well as calling this number, 604-822-8648 or 604-UBC-UNIT. And a volunteer will be able to help you with your donation. Again, even though FundRev is officially over as of March 6th, which is today, but you can still donate and you can still help out the station, and it really does make a big difference. So if you're a fan of the sector or any show here on CITR, we'd really appreciate your support right now. And there's lots of great content coming up down the road on CITR, including our new studio, which is going to be really exciting. It's very different from where we are right now, which is kind of buried away in the Student Union building. This new studio is going to be front and center. It's going to be very exciting. I hope you'll come down and take a look at it when it's ready. Just a reminder that if you're listening on Friday, there is the Fundrive finale, which is happening at Pat's Pub. It's going to have a rock and roll lottery, which sounds exciting. The doors open at 8 p.m. The band start at 9. And the location is Pat's Pub, which is 403 East Hastings Street. Tickets are $10 in advance or $12 at the door. And again, all that goes into helping CITR with operational costs, producing content, licensing music, and just in general, staying awesome. So I hope that you'll support CITR, and if you get a chance to check out the Fund Drive finale, please do so. Now, speaking of the Fund Drive, I actually did a Fund Drive special on Tuesday with my good buddy Don McLennigan from Radio Free Thinker. We also had the programming manager, Robin Alum, join us, so that was a lot of fun. We talked about CITR, about our unique motivations for doing radio here at the station, how we got started, and a bit about the sector, about Radio Free Thinker, things that were making news, things that were happening, and it was a lot of fun. It was great to sit down with Don again, and it's always a good time to sort of just talk a bit about social justice and science and skepticism, and you know how much I love that kind of stuff anyway. So that'll be on our podcast feed. In fact, it should be there right now. So you can go there and check it out. And again, all that information that we gave out on that show for donating is still valid. You can totally donate if you want right now or tomorrow or the next day. So don't feel like you missed Fund Drive. You can totally take part. And again, it does make a huge difference for CITR, and it makes a big difference for our ability to stay in operation. Well, let's just take a quick break here on the show. We got a lot of great content coming up. This is episode 38 of The Sector, and we will return after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dantry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotus Land Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station.
Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on.
College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism, of course, on CITR. Now, some interesting news has come my way this last little while. And it happens to involve something that's not entirely connected to the realm of social justice and nonprofits, but nonetheless, very, very interesting. Kind of a science story, but with a connection to one of my favorite foods, that is Indian food. I just love me some curry and some pakoras and some naan bread. But, you know, I've always wondered why is it that it seems like Indian food is just so indescribably tasty? Why is it that once I start thinking about it, I just can't stop? And after I finish this, I'm going to go get some right now. But why is that? What is it about that food that just makes me go crazy for it? So these group of scientists, they got together for the most tasty experiment ever. And they went through a bunch of Indian recipes for various food dishes. And they examined the ingredients and, you know, the sort of nuts and bolts of the ingredients and how they all factored together. And what's interesting is that it's kind of reversed for how food is prepared in Western Europe or North America or other places, where here, locally, what we do is we try to find ingredients that complement each other. And we kind of try to fit them together that way. So we put food together with, you know, oh, this goes well with that, and this flavor enhances this flavor, and that flavor kind of is like this flavor, so let's put those together. Whereas with Indian food, it's kind of reversed. They don't do that. In Indian food, you're very unlikely to find another ingredient that shares the same components as another ingredient. Now, some of the spices have complementary but not identical attributes. It's actually true across all different kinds of Indian food, from Bengali to Punjabi to South Indian. So this is kind of a really unique cultural thing. It's, I guess, unsurprising that it's actually the spices and the method of preparing those combinations that create sort of that character-defining element of Indian cuisine. So the idea that like flavors should be combined for better dishes, which is popular here, completely reversed in India, and the result is really, really, really tasty food. So I guess as a way to kind of tie this into the whole social justice thing, maybe open to the idea that just because you've been doing something for a long time a certain way doesn't mean it's the best way. And we have, you know, chicken vindaloo to prove the fact of that. It's a very tenuous analogy, but it's my show. And because of CITR and supporting CITR, you allow me to talk about whatever the heck I want on The Sector. So I appreciate that. But to go on to perhaps more serious topics and to explore a question, I guess, in a bit more detail, I'd like to bring up something that kind of was going through my mind the last few days. As I mentioned, on Tuesday, we did this fundraising spectacular show with Radio Free Thinker. And so for that, you know, I was down at UBC. I was down on campus, wandering around, taking in the rather shocking beauty that is UBC. It was a fantastic day. And, you know, I thought, well, I haven't been on campus in a decent amount of time, and I haven't been a student on campus in an even longer amount of time. So maybe I'll, you know, go check out some of my old stomping grounds. And I took a look at the library and, you know, kind of walked my route. And I went over to the UBC bookstore, which has surprisingly changed a little bit since last time I was there. Bit more spacious. Prices still expensive, but nevertheless, it's changed a little bit. And I was, you know, perusing the books and seeing what was out there. And I saw a very interesting display. It was set up as kind of a banned books corner, which I think is a great thing for a university bookstore to have. That's, you know, wonderful. I applaud that. Anyway, so I was very curious, and I went over and started looking over these books, and they had these signs that said this book was censored, and then there was a bunch of reasons, like why a book might be censored, and whatever the book it was, they would highlight the reason why somebody somewhere had banned it. So it might have been for religious reasons, it might have been for something like obscenities, or cultural reasons, government censorship, all kinds of things, right? They had the Communist Manifesto, and it was, you know, they had written down political criticism and social upheaval, that kind of stuff. So you got an idea of like what kind of category each thing was banned in. And it got me kind of thinking because, you know, we often talk about the idea of, can there be a valid use of censorship? And, you know, this came up a lot on my old show with Radio Free Thinker with Don, but I wanted to sort of throw this out here on the sector and kind of talk about maybe some of the ramifications, or at least kind of do a bit of a thought experiment when it comes to what we allow, what we don't allow, and what we censor. Now, you may be wondering what books were kind of singled out for censorship. And of course, you had the usual suspects there, right? You had Catcher in the Rye, To Kill a Mockingbird. You had some of the philosophical books by Socrates, Aristotle, so forth. You know, obviously banned for not being in tune with the sort of moral compass of the day type thing. You had things like Huckleberry Finn, lots of books by Mark Twain. Then you also had some things that maybe you wouldn't expect to see there, sort of like The Hunger Games, Harry Potter. Maybe Harry Potter is kind of expected, but, you know, it was there. Lord of the Rings, that kind of stuff. But also 50 Shades of Grey, you know, okay. The Twilight books, the ones with the glittery vampires. Modern fiction that oftentimes I think has been kind of criticized for lacking in literary merit, but is still nonetheless banned. Now, a few other things that was there that I was a little bit surprised by. There were a few political books. Again, the Communist Manifesto, that wasn't too surprising. But there were a few others that I thought, well, that's interesting. One of them was Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. And, you know, that kind of took me a bit by surprise because here's the interesting question that I want to maybe segue this into is if we're going to censor something and if we're going to rebel against that censorship, does the book in question, and I suppose it doesn't have to be a book, but let's just say book for this example, does the book in question have to have literary merit? See, what I mean by that is I think most of us would agree, and stripping aside the, you know, idea of elitism and literary elitism, whatever that may be, but most of us would probably agree that the books of Mark Twain probably have more importance than, you know, the Twilight books. And that's not to say that, you know, vampires and whatnot aren't as artistic quotation marks as Mark Twain, I think that you could argue that Dracula and some of the more groundbreaking vampire stories actually do earn a place along with Mark Twain's books. But the question is, if we're going to be fighting censorship, if we're going to be rebelling against this notion that there is good things to read and bad things to read, do we also have a interest, a good reason to focus in on the things that have a tangible impact on society? Books that have meaning, books that have more value than the story it tells, is perhaps a good way to put it. You know, nothing against somebody who reads a book like Twilight or 50 Shades of Grey and gets enjoyment out of it. That's one thing. That's fine. That's great for you. But do those books have any kind of larger impact on society that goes beyond mere enjoyment? Does it change anything? Does it have any kind of cultural significance? And of course, that's hard to answer with a new book. I'm aware of that. And, you know, that's going to take time to develop. But when you look at something like Mark Twain or To Kill a Mockingbird or, you know, heck, even the Communist Manifesto, you can clearly see a cultural icon there. You can see how that has affected more than simply because it's a good story, more than simply because the characters are entertaining. It has pushed beyond that, and it's created a very hard to doubt and very hard to notice, or not hard to notice, impact on society. You know, Mark Twain, obviously the reason why his books are often banned is because of the language. It was written at a time when, you know, that language was commonplace, but nowadays is not considered polite for, you know, civil company. And likewise, the way that he portrays people in his books, the racism, the sort of childlike innocence of characters like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. You know, these are guys who go around with like, a cat's tail, and they carry knives and stuff like that. It's not like it's the kind of appropriate reading you want to give a little kid and be like, hey, yeah, carry around this knife with you. But that being said, we also know that Mark Twain himself sort of put that stuff in the book for a reason, and that he knew that he was playing with perceptions. He knew that he was ruffling feathers when he had characters in there that had, you know, racist things to say, but there was a method to it. It wasn't simply he was putting it in there for shock value. He was putting it in there to tell a very important message. So does that give him more of a pass when we look at the value of his work compared to something like Twilight or The Hunger Games or Lord of the Rings? So the question is, you know, do we have to choose our battles with the books that we defend from censorship? Do we have an obligation to make sure we're talking about books that have merit beyond simply the enjoyment of reading? I don't know. I don't really have an answer to that question, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. So please email me and let me know what you think. Now, I mentioned that I was surprised to see Hitler's Mein Kampf there. And I think that leads to a kind of another question, perhaps a bit more uncomfortable, but nonetheless, I think important. And that is the question of, do we even want to defend certain books? Do we even care that certain books are censored? Because if we're going to acknowledge the fact that certain books have more literary merit than others, why do we even keep around certain books that have no merit? Now, with, you know, a book like that, you could argue, I guess, from a historical point of view, that it is a necessary document, that it helps us understand history, and that it helps us understand the viewpoints and understand, and, you know, the opinions of that age, which is fine. I guess, you know, it could belong in a university library or, you know, in a scholarly setting. But whether or not we need to be selling it at Chapters or selling it online or on Amazon, that remains to be seen. You know, when I saw it, I was a bit offended. I was a bit surprised. The idea that anybody could find merit outside of scholarly historical analysis is a little bit shocking. I mean, as a society, are we made any better by allowing Mein Kampf out there? Like, does that have a net positive gain by making sure that that book is available? Or are we diminished as a society by having it out there? I don't know. But it does raise this interesting question, because if we're going to say that there is and isn't such a thing as literary merit, if we're going to say, for instance, that Mark Twain and his books are necessary, are important, have value, have cultural significance, and a book like 50 Shades of Grey is insulting and potentially abusive and has all these negative connotations to it, should not be popular, should not be what it is today, then don't we also have to say, well, then there, and we're kind of actually agreeing that there is cause for censorship, that there is good reason to ban a book. So, I mean, I don't know. What do you all think? And I want to hear your thoughts on this. This is sort of a return of the big question of the week, I guess, actually. So email me at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Ethan Clow, that's me, or at Sector Podcast on Twitter. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And of course, at our website, you can comment and you can download our podcast at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. So let me know what you think about this whole like book censorship thing and my little thought experiment here. Hopefully we can get a bit of a dialogue going and kind of understand how we feel about the idea of recognizing different qualities, different classes of literature, and should we be banning certain classes of literature? I don't know. Let's discuss it more. Well, before we go on, let's take a quick break here on the show. And just once again, reminding everybody that if you haven't donated to CITR's fund drive, you still can do so. Go to CITR.ca, throw in a few dollars, help us out. We're trying to raise $40,000 to keep CITR operational on the air and producing great content like this. We'll be right back after this break.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Oh.
Isn't there
anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR, 101.9 FM, or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Welcome back to The Sector, talking about nonprofits, social justice, and activism here on the show. With me, your host, Ethan Clow. So we just finished talking a bit about free speech, censorship, and books. So I'd love to hear your feedback on that. And again, do let me know what you think. You know, segueing from the idea of talking about the merit of certain books, whether or not they belong in society, we were mentioning Mein Kampf by Hitler and whether or not that has any merit outside of historical research. I found a different story that does sort of tie into this, and it's something of interest, I think, to the social justice proponent out there. This story comes to us from the BBC. A 94-year-old man has been charged with 3,681 counts of accessory to murder in Germany on allegations that he served at Auschwitz, the Nazi Germany concentration and death camp. Prosecutors said the defendant was a former SS sergeant who acted as a medical officer in the death camp in 1944. If found guilty, he could face jail time ranging from 3 to 15 years. He has a defense lawyer, Peter Michael Distel, who told Bild newspaper there was no evidence of a concrete criminal act. Now, the prosecutors can't name this man for privacy laws, but despite his advanced age, they say that he is fit to stand trial. It is alleged that in his role as a medical officer, he helped the camp function and could therefore be linked to deaths that occurred during this period of service from the 15th of August to September 14th, 1944. As people probably know, about 1.1 million people, mostly European Jews, were killed at Auschwitz between 1940 and 1945. Now, we've heard more and more of these cases coming to light in the last few years. Elderly, mostly men, who served as Nazis in World War II, being found out, being brought to trial to face justice for these crimes that they committed. In some cases, they were more perpetrators than others. So, for instance, you had people who actually shot weapons and killed people physically compared to people who sort of were accessories to murder. This case follows a precedent set when a German court charged a 93-year-old man with 170,000 counts of accessory to murder on allegations that he served as an SS guard at a death camp. He allegedly served in Auschwitz from 1942 to 1944. Another former Nazi guard is due to go on trial in April, charged with at least 300,000 counts of accessory to murder. Oskar Gröning, also 93, was known as the bookkeeper of Auschwitz and was allegedly responsible for counting banknotes confiscated from prisoners. So, I mean, you have a lot of these older men who have been found out, who are being brought to justice, put on trial at very elderly ages, 93, 94, older, a little bit younger, 80s, in their 80s, that kind of thing. So it does raise the question of, certainly no one would deny that the victims of the Holocaust deserve justice. No one would deny that it's not important to seek out the perpetrators and make sure that at some point in their life, they do face some kind of justice, they face some kind of court. But the other interesting aspect about this, and something that I remember speaking about when I was doing my history degree at UBC, was the need to punish these people. You know, again, many of them are quite elderly. They don't have much longer left in life at the age of 93. So what sort of penalty do these people typically get? Well, a lot of times they get kind of symbolic penalties. They spend a day or two in jail or a week in jail. And because of their advanced age, it's not like they're going to run away or anything like that. So they're often given these kind of symbolic punishments designed to indicate that there is a sense of justice and that there is a sense of restitution going on for these crimes. Now, some have criticized these gestures, calling them hollow, calling them meaningless, and that if it was truly genuine, that they should have been enacted many, many years ago, that these current trials are more about publicity and creating the intention of appearing to want to correct the wrongs of history. And it, I think, falls into an interesting discussion about the notion of correcting past wrongs. You know, this is certainly something that here in Canada, we have no shortage of past wrongs to correct. There's everything from the internment of Asian Canadians during World War II because they looked Japanese. There's the systemic racism that existed in Canada, typically towards First Nations. I mean, you look at some of the horrific things that were done in the name of preserving Canada's national identity. Shocking brutality that even today we're still kind of only scratching the surface on. And of course, you know, there's many other examples of the way that Canada had an unfortunately a very racist past that we're only kind of now realizing. This has provoked a lot of discussion about what can Canada do as a nation to find restitution for these things. Public apologies are often sort of the go-to example, I think, for politicians, at least. This often earns a lot of, I think, like discord from sort of the typical kind of conservative base here in Canada. I remember having a discussion with this with somebody a few years ago about the idea of Stephen Harper apologizing for an incident. I apologize, I forget what it was, but the conversation basically went that, well, it wasn't like, you know, Stephen Harper did it, and it wasn't like any of us were alive when this happened. Well, yeah, I know, but I mean, the point being is these crimes were created, they were perpetrated by individuals who thought they were acting in the good of the country. And even though they're no longer here, a lot of us benefited quite directly from those decisions. And I think that if it happened today, we would all be justly outraged. So to look back on these mistakes of history and kind of wave our hand and say, well, we weren't there, it wasn't our problem, that doesn't really address any of the issues. That's just to absolve yourself of guilt. And that's not helpful. Addressing these concerns takes courage, it takes integrity, and it also requires you to kind of look ahead to the future and make sure that you're not going to allow these sort of things to happen again. If you acknowledge that you did something wrong in the past, whether it was a racist or more of a systemic kind of class or race-based discrimination, and you acknowledge that, it can make you a bit more aware of how things are happening currently that you can actually do things to prevent. A great example, of course, is if you look at the way First Nations have been treated in Canada. The lying, the theft of land, the treatment by Canadian officials, church officials, etc. You know, the residential schools, of course, is the big example. But if we can acknowledge that and recognize that as wrong, as racist, as terrible, does that not give us some political will to change current issues? The refusal by the Harper government and conservatives to not investigate the murdered Aboriginal women all over Canada, the Harper government, of course, saying that they're treating this as a crime, and that they do not need to review it as a special crime, that they do not need an inquiry or an inquest to examine how these crimes were ignored and how they were allowed to continue, and why there is no plan anywhere that will allow Canada to move beyond this, to make sure that these incidents don't keep happening. Without that, all we can do is chase this problem around, wagging our finger at it. And Stephen Harper goes around and suggests that the way to solve these problems are with tougher sentencing. Well, no, it's not, because it doesn't matter if you're a murderer out there. You're not going to say, geez, I shouldn't murder somebody because now the life sentence is longer than 25 years. That's not going to have an impact on people, of course. So again, it comes down to this question of examining the wrongs of the past, acknowledging them, and allowing that to inform you as you move forward. So, again, interesting discussion. Let's get your feedback on that. Email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And, of course, you can tweet your comments to me at Ethan Clow on Twitter and at sectorpodcast on Twitter. Look forward to reading them. Well, I think we're going to take a quick musical interlude to clear the palate here on The Sector. So, coming up next, we have It's Up to You Now by the Black Keys. This is off their new album, Turn Blue, which came out in 2014. Let's tune into that, and we'll be right back after this.
Know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
We are back on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, talking about nonprofits and social justice here on CITR. Before the break, I played for you It's Up to You Now by the Black Keys off of their new album Turn Blue. Well, new as in 2014. A very well-reviewed album. Rolling Stone ranked it as the third best album of 2014. So, very exciting. Anyway, back to the show. So unless you were living under a rock, you may have heard about this stupid thing called the dress. And what color is the dress? And how important is the dress? And why is it blue? And why is it white? Why is it green? Blah, blah, blah. Who cares? The point being is it's a stupid optical illusion that for some reason took the internet by storm. Because sometimes the internet is stupid. Now, as you can probably tell, I was not impressed by this thing going viral. I thought it was pretty dumb. But it actually provoked some interesting discussion in the sense that people were debating, how did this stupid thing become so big? Why did such a stupid thing become so big? And what can we learn about that in terms of viralness of various memes and ideas? This led me to read an interesting article that I radically disagreed with, but nonetheless, I thought was kind of provocative. So I wanted to share some of the ideas in this article and, you know, with you, our listeners, about the idea of, you know, how things go viral, what makes them go viral, and why is it that we seem to have this sort of aversion to talking about, you know, important things instead of these, you know, what color is this dress? So let's dive into that right now. Now, this article appeared in Gizmodo and talked a bit about sort of flash media in terms of these extraordinary events happen. There is a ton of media attention and then they quickly disappear. And moreover, people seem to just totally forget about them. And it's like you have amnesia about remembering these events. Now, where this sort of went off the rails, I feel, in the article was that the author started comparing things like the dress and other kind of flash media stories to Ferguson, and how, pointing out quite rightly, that black men are killed by police in America all the time. And yet each incident doesn't create a media storm or frenzy around it the same way that Ferguson did. Now, what this fails to understand, of course, is that indeed black lives are seen as less valuable by media in America. The fact that on a very frequent basis, black people are gunned down by police officers in a variety of different circumstances, usually facing no consequences whatsoever, that is a media story. It should be a media story. The fact that it isn't raises very disturbing questions about how we view race-based violence in America. I mean, we, as in North Americans, when we look at race-based violence. I think the same can be said about Canada. Talking earlier about the inquiry into the murdered Aboriginal women all across Canada, that issue wasn't getting media attention before. These murders, these disappearances, this situation has been ongoing for years and years. And yet, it's only relatively recently that that's generated any kind of attention. Why? Why does this happen? Well, it has very little to do with kind of internet memes and a media frenzy the way that this article suggests, pointing to stories like the balloon boy or those llamas that got loose. Those circumstances created a disproportionate interest because of the fact that they were so innocuous and stupid. Yet a serious story with consequences and with ramifications like Ferguson, those often fall by the wayside. It's really only under certain circumstances does media really focus on these issues, creating that kind of flash media storm. Another example is the O.J. Simpson circumstances when he was driving down that highway in that white car, right? You know, the article specifically mentions one very interesting point that I think is worthy of focusing on. To quote from the article, black men are killed by the police every day under questionable circumstances, and it goes unreported and unshared on social media. Why did Michael Brown's death spark a flash political movement while so many others didn't? And later in the article, it's not that we didn't know this before, we just forgot. And again, I think it's important to point out that no, people did know about this, they just didn't care about this. The media didn't care about this. This wasn't considered news. This wasn't considered something that the average American, or in Canada, the average Canadian, would want to know about. In Canada, we could talk about the murdered Aboriginal women. So to say that there is some kind of psychological or internet conspiracy, whether it's intentional or not, that allows us to focus on things as stupid and as pointless as the dress and ignore pivotal moments like Ferguson or other social justice issues. It's not to suggest that there is one of those things. In reality, it's simply a question of where do people devote their attention? Where do people consider these stories to be important? And the fact that so many people devoted so much energy into discussing something as pointless as this dress's color, well, really important things like Ferguson are happening, indicates that we have a society that is more or less unwilling to look at serious issues. It's not a question of psychology or sociology. It's a question of people's willingness to examine these issues critically. You know, back when we talked about Ferguson the first time, we talked a bit about how riots are reported and how how media will either demify or gloss over the realities of a riot. So, for instance, we looked at how rioting in Ferguson was reported, how it was described as looting and criminal activity, and there was lots of focus on the way that these rioters were breaking windows and smashing cars and stealing things, and it was really bad. The focus becomes, what are these criminals doing? The focus shifts away from looking at the issues, what provoked the riot, why is there so much anger, to focusing only on the anger. When you compare this to the way that rioting has been reported on when it relates to sports, and again, you know, this often does have a racial tint to it, in that a lot of the sports riots that we talked about on that past episode were primarily white people's riots, riots over hockey or football or baseball. And the way that those are often reported starkly contrasts to the way that a racial riot is profiled. When media portrays a group of protesters, regardless of what they're protesting, by the propensity for violence, the possibility of looting, of violence, or an outbreak of civil unrest, more often than not, it is portrayed in a very negative light. And this can be applied to protesters of environmental issues. You know, the protesting that was going on Burnaby Mountain here locally in Vancouver. When you portray that in the media as these people are rabble-rousers, these people are up to no good, there is the potential for violent spillover, that these people could at any minute turn into wild monsters. That form of framing the story is so common with these incidences like the shooting in Ferguson or the shooting or the murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida. It is not the same as how media focuses on other issues that typically don't involve social inequality, social justice, poverty, or, you know, obviously the murder of black people by white police officers. Anyway, we're kind of getting a bit off topic here. I want to back up and maybe reaffirm my point here. A lot of people make the claim that as a society, we've become very consumer-based in terms of our media, in terms of the way that we consume news. So that we have this notion of, give me something exciting, something new, something fantastic, and I will gobble it up. I will regurgitate it. I will, you know, understand it and share it on Facebook and share it on Twitter and try to make it go viral. And then once that's done, I don't want to see it anymore. I don't want to acknowledge it anymore. I want to push it to the back of society, and I want something new and exciting to take its place. So you see this a lot in kind of like this kind of pop culture notion of news, in that there's never any kind of long-term debate or analysis over any of these facts. It always is what's next, what next, what's next. You look at CNN or any of the big news networks, and it's always like this scroll of news stories. You know, boom, this has happened. Boom, this has happened. Boom, this has happened. And we never get any chance to sit down and carefully reflect on any of these things. It's always about what big story is next. What is the next big thing? Instead of just being given the opportunity to properly digest something and understand it, provide like follow-up, real follow-up, it's always going to be shifting to the next big story. So in the case of something like Ferguson, where there's all this coverage of the incident, and then there's all this coverage of the aftermath, the rioting, looting, the resolution in the courts. But after that, that news cycle just kind of collapses in on of itself. And the next big thing comes along, you know, some llamas escape and now we have to follow them with helicopters type thing. Instead, have the news refocus on Ferguson in the aftermath of Ferguson. Provide real analysis that isn't based on sort of this kind of 24-hour news cycle, but is rather based on let's reflect, let's understand what's happening. Let's talk to the people who are involved in this sort of thing, understand the point of view of the people who are protesting, the point of view of the people who are protesting the protesting, get a firmer grasp. Again, you know, Ferguson has started to fade to the background of mainstream media in much the same way that the Trayvon Martin murder faded to the background. Once that Zimmerman guy got off and there wasn't a news story there anymore, the attention just faded away. And there's still outrage. There's still people who are upset and trying to understand. Likewise, when the incident in New York happened with the man who was choked to death by the police officers, who again got off scot-free, that shifted the attention away from Ferguson. Now I think it's even shifted off of that incident as well, and we're talking about something else entirely. And not to suggest that we always have to focus on the same thing, but we have this notion of media as this constantly shifting, unwilling to focus, unwilling to provide real insight thing that is feeding this mass monster. And I don't know if the monster in this case is the public or if it's this kind of perception of the public that they constantly need new things. And there is really no examination of that. It's just, here's the next big thing. And as somebody who cares about social justice, who cares about activism and making the world a better place, this is very frustrating. It's disturbing to see the way that we hyper-focus on things. And I guess you could, I don't know if you could call it the Facebookization of news and information, but it's the dumbing down of information. It's reducing it to its soundbite qualities. Stripping away all the substance, all the nuance, and all the, well, the important things, the rational bits that help us make up our mind and form opinions, trying to squeeze that all down into the most trendable and viral elements. I don't think that's a helpful process. I don't think that that helps us understand things any better. Consuming things with meat on them, with tangible and graspable points and arguments and statements that we can debate on, that we can have a thorough conversation about, that's where we're going to change, you know, hearts and minds. That's the point that allows us to make the world a better place. It's not finding the cleverest meme or the most viral video that can sweep across YouTube and get a billion views. It's about trying to reach people and trying to educate them, trying to change minds. And you can't do that with these short 30-second sound bites. So what do you think of the media concentration, the examination of critical topics that is going on in today's media? Is it good? Is it bad? Do you think it's better than it has been before? Or has it gotten worse? Let me know here on The Sector. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Of course, tweet us at Ethan Clow or at Sector Podcast. And we'll discuss it. We'll get into it in more detail because that's what we do here on The Sector. We discuss things in detail because that's how things get done. Anyway, we are running out of time here on the show. So I'm going to wrap things up. Once again, thanking you all for tuning in. A reminder, if you haven't donated to CITR, please do so. It is a important and vital source of news, culture, and media, of diverse voices, of independent thought that you don't get very often in commercial radio, or hardly at all, frankly. So please consider supporting CITR. Again, you can do so at citr.ca even after the fund drive is over. You can still call and donate at 604-822-8648 or UBC Unit 604. And again, help CITR. attend the Big Fun Dive finale. If you're listening live, it's tonight at Pat's Pub. It should be a lot of fun. And, of course, continue to listen and be an informed member of the public. Well, this is Ethan Clow, host of The Sector, saying thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. Have a fantastic weekend, and we will see you next week here on The Sector. Stay tuned, because Up on the Roof is next.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Cue it up Wednesdays 3 to 4.
I mean, I just wanted to do a nice experimental music radio show and maybe throw in some
just feeling
nice talking that anonymous, like, private body sense in your podcast. I mean, I think I can talk, and that's good enough.
Fight or flight music sometimes for things that are not all right.
I just
radio essays and travesties, radio catechisms, half-baked philosophy and criticism, experimental beat music, avant-garde, post-punk, industrial, noise, ad nauseum. Cue it up.
Wednesdays, 3 to 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
I don't know if I've ever told this story.
In the late 80s and early 90s,